Hell yeah.
The Gaming Guru Podcast. Detail the best gaming podcast in the world.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Gaming Guru Podcast. We took a little bit of a break last week because one of us, myself, managed to get themselves Corona Light, and that's just a common cold. But in the world we live in today, you kind of wonder sometimes what you've managed to catch. But we are back and finally going to jump back into the moral gray soup that we began bathing. I think we're sufficiently simmered at the moment through the topic. Thanks for all the awesome feedback that we received on Twitter and the likes. Guys are really enjoying the content, and so thank you very much. And today, we want to jump back in with a little bit more elaboration on some of the other points. But just a quick recap. For those who didn't catch the first one, please, if you want to and you're interested in the subject of morality in games, does it exist? You know, what part does it play? We jumped into it in quite heavy detail. But maybe, Tim, if we can do a quick recap, perhaps you want to mention or just chat through the different types of morality we see in games, for as an example.
Yeah, thanks, G. So, I mean, you know, looking at how we broke up this morality quadrant in sort of layman's terms, there's definitely a big segment of games that would fall into this black and white morality category, where the good guys are always good, will always be good, the bad guys always bad, will always be bad and do bad things, you know, games like, you know, Mario, Sonic, Doom. And then a more nuanced approach where you where the lines aren't as clear in a gray moral sort of background, games like The Last of Us, Grand Theft Auto might fall there. We also looked a bit at like neutral morality, or games that kind of don't sit on a moral scale at all. Those are usually like puzzle games that take characterization like out of the gaming like mechanism completely. So like Tetris, for example, most puzzle games, some racing games. And then there are also games that we kind of touched on that allow the player themselves to choose between either of these paths. You know, we're looking at things like The Witcher, where, you know, or BioWare games, where they have like quite a clear morality system and then appropriate responses that allow the player to kind of move the character into those different directions. But I think what I really want to sort of investigate and unpack today is kind of like, now that we've sort of gone through all of these different different categories, is how that actually affects us as the player, and how our own ideas of morality get injected into the way that we play our game, or are those views influenced by the games that we play?
Yeah, 100%. I think what's key is, you've mentioned that most of those types of morality are dictated to us by the game itself. And except for those where you get to choose your own moral path. And to be honest, we touched on last week about how sometimes players can even forcibly co-opt a game and force a different moral narrative, such as people who do speed runs or do full pacifist runs. So there are games that, for example, I think Skyrim was one of the classics where, I mean, it's a 100-hour odd game that you can potentially beat the entire game without killing anybody, because even the major like kind of gatekeeping bosses that you have to kind of defeat to get past, you can influence other characters to do that for you. So you sit around, you know, mind controlling or healing them or whatever, and they're doing all the work. So technically you can go, there's no blood on my hands because I've done absolutely nothing. So you can finish those entire games without doing, you know, any, I've seen, for example, as a really weird example of forcing a moral narrative, I've seen guys do Mario runs as a, what they call a totally Zen or totally like non-capitalist approach, where you will not only do you not kill a single thing, but you don't collect a single coin, because collecting coins is also like, you know, whatever, greed and capitalism, all that. So guys do entire runs of Mario without dying themselves, killing anything else, or collecting coins. And so obviously the guys who developed the game aren't going, well, that's an important way to play the game, you know, unlock an achievement. That's people forcing their own narrative. And like you said, Tim, I think what's key here is there's the game, the rules have been set, whether it's a puzzle game, a racing game, fighting game, whatever. But how often do we as the player get to insert our own moral agenda into the game? You know, whether we are a full pacifist or we're, you know, we spoke about those alignment grids. Are we full chaotic neutral or total neutral or, you know, good or whatever? And how even the darkest games might be changed by having a different character.
Yeah. And I think sort of a word that I want to kind of like focus on here is, you know, is killing, right? When we, when you, you know, just gave me that example of these kind of pacifist speed runs, you know, we kind of like gravitate towards that word, you know, because killing, you know, is bad in a morally just like real world. But in the video game world, is killing bad? Killing is just what another mechanism that the game has given you in order to like, in order to beat its levels. You know, if you think, if we, you know, take into consideration that a video game is just a platform that has been designed in order to get a player from A to B to C, and with various obstacles in the way, that obstacle can be a humanoid enemy or enemies that need to be eliminated or killed. So in a sense, there isn't really like a moral judgment to be made about whether it's good or bad to kill something if that something is just another mechanic in the video game. Yeah. But maybe that's something that we should like unpack a bit more.
Yeah, because I think what's interesting you mentioned there is it's potentially how a lot of games have got around certain censorship issues. Is you go, for example, I think quite recently, PUBG in China, they the character's not eliminated. They're kind of like literally wave goodbye and are teleported away. Similarly to kind of how, what's it, Fortnite does it. You know, in Fortnite, there are no kills, it's an elimination. So as you down the player, they're crawling and then they don't bleed out or anything. The timer runs out and they are kind of disintegrated, not even disintegrated. They're kind of absorbed by some sort of bot and teleported away as if they were not even real. They were just some sort of hologram, as it were.
Yeah.
And so you kind of go, and, you know, as I say that, I remember, what is it? The Mortal Kombat, when it first came out, it also, there was a certain areas you couldn't have blood. And so they solved some of the ban, you know, restrictions by just turning it into sweat or oil or whatever. That was just like, it wasn't blood and therefore it's not violent. And so you kind of go, are there certain lines where morality kind of kicks in? So you go, okay, I'm shooting another human being and they bleed and scream in pain. Therefore this is bad. So that's like, let's call that on the spectrum, the R-rated kind of ranking.
Yeah.
So then we go, cool. We take the blood away. Maybe that's enough to drop to a, you know, a mature rating. And then we take away the fact they're humans and they're actually robots. And then we take away the fact that instead of shooting bullets, I'm shooting, like, look at games like Splatoon. I'm shooting paint or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you start dropping it that they're not even robots or, you know, humanoid looking. They are random shapes. So I'm a triangle shooting a bunch of squares with paint. And all of a sudden it becomes a super friendly game that was suitable of like a Nintendo Mario Party type mini game, when essentially you haven't changed anything except for some of the visual aspects of a Call of Duty or any other kind of super violent shooting game.
Yeah. And I like your example of Mortal Kombat, because like, as you said it, I just remember, you know, like, playing the game when I was a kid and these huge like blood sprays, but because it's like, you know, 2D like pixel animation, like those blood sprays, I mean, they don't look nearly as realistic as some of, you know, the blood effects and gore effects that we get in some games today, yet they're still treated with that same bar and same measure, in terms of their rating or classification, you know, like, a game like that today would it still get the same type of rating? I mean, there's something.
Yeah, good question.
Is there something to be said about the realism aspect of it?
Yeah.
Because like cartoon paint like blood is very different to like, you know, that realistic visceral like gore.
100%. Yeah, and you wonder sometimes where obviously that is more a case of the limitations of the hardware and the processing power at the time. So, I mean, if the guys at it wasn't NetherRealm Studios at the time, it would have been Midway. At the time, if they could have made it super hyper realistic photographic style, they would have. I mean, you can see they did it. They tried that in terms of digitizing actual actors. It wasn't, you know, 3D animated characters. They were actually mocapped sort of actors, which was super novel for the time, especially for fighting games. And so they were kind of marked as realistic gore, whatever, for the time. But you wonder now, because we know that that stuff is available, whether decisions, stylistic decisions to make things more or less gory help or hinder a game's rating. For example, I mean, Hotline Miami is quite a recent game that is fairly brutal in its portrayal of, you know, violence and gore and the kind of drug cartels and that. And I mean, even with that, you think of a game like Broforce, it's ridiculous what you do. Like, you'd be blowing pixels up into smithereens and all that. And if that were a hyper-realistic game, it would be rated, you know, super M, if there's such a thing. But it gets by because it's, as you said, it's just pixels. And almost you teleport that game back to the era of Mortal Kombat 1, you'd go, yeah, it would probably get struck with the same sort of major rating. But now it's almost like it's cartoony. Yes, it's gratuitous, but it's, yeah, like you said, it's cartoony. It's more over the top than real. It's pixelated. So that all kind of removes a lot of, I mean, I think, for example, if as a parent, if I had my, maybe not my 4-year-old, but if I had like a 10-year-old playing Broforce, I don't think I'd have a big deal about it. You know what I mean? That's my personal feeling.
Which means that like our ideas of acceptable like levels of violence have also changed over time, because, you know, a pixeled blood splatter is more acceptable to us. And like you say, you don't mind your kid like, you know, consuming that content. But then compare that to, let's say, a Last of Us, for instance, where it's like visceral realism. Like that's 100%. A level of violence that a lot of us might be uncomfortable with.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, talking about you having your kid play games, part of the problem with kids playing super violent games is their inability to distinguish over time between reality and the fact that they're in a game. That's why they pretty much patently like let you know, like their warning signs all over when it comes to VR. Don't let kids under 12 use VR, even if it is the cartoony stuff, because it is so hard for them to distinguish between what's real and what they see in the game. And so you have a kid playing a game like a Broforce that, you know, it's hyper-violent, but it's cartoony. I don't think any child over 4 thinks this is real in any way, shape, or form. Like, they can see it's cartoony. They can see it's a game. You know what I mean? They don't feel as in – I mean, they might get frustrated and personally invested in their characters, you know, winning or losing the stage, but they're never going to feel like that's me dying and those are real bad guys I'm killing. Yeah. Whereas as games get more realistic, geez, I find it hard to distinguish as, you know, as a 36-year-old. So I can't imagine what a 10 or 12-year-old, especially some of the first-person camera angle type stuff, their inability to distinguish between what's real and what's a game. So I think that's a huge factor in terms of, I don't know if the censorship people take that into account, you know, realism and indistinguishableness from nature, you know, like from, you know, being the themes are realistic. I think as soon as stuff goes over the top, you sometimes almost err on the side of, I don't mean over the top in terms of gratuitous, but over the top in terms of unrealistic, that you almost start waning away from, you know, it being hard to distinguish. As we mentioned, for example, instead of humans, it's aliens. Instead of guns shooting bullets, it's bubbles and lasers and stuff like that. As you start moving towards those things, it's like, this is okay. Kids will know this is a game and not real.
So you mentioned FPS games, and I think this is a good point to kind of like, you know, pivot on, simply because, so in FPS games, the problem solving is then eliminating the enemies, you know, with whatever, you know, sort of like language and iconography they want to use in that, whether it's, you know, military, law enforcement, or otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, the gun is essentially in your hand. You haven't really got a choice about that. Your choices are which gun to have in your hands. It's like, do I use the shotgun? Do I use the wrench? Do I use the, you know, the BFG? Like, those are your choices. You can't, in a game of COD or CSGO, like, you know, go up to the enemy team and be like, hey man, why don't we like have a truce here, shake hands,
Let's put talk our guns it out, down. Yeah.
Because that's, you're not going to win the game. You're not going to beat the scenario, the level. So then how does that, you know, how does that reflect your own kind of perception of your morality?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned military, because I think a key point thinking about it now in the terminology that the military uses is it's very much like, not inhuman, but or dehumanizing, but like very, you know, numbers and call signs. It's Charlie, it's, you know, it's whatever. But you're not talking about... Yeah, it's bogeys. It's you know, I can't even think of the terms because I'm not in the military, but it's really just like targets on a firing range is the kind of attitude towards your opponents. You know, they're key assets and they are key targets or whatever, but it's very seldom that it's, you know, Joe Soap that you're killing or this particular target or whatever. It's very much, it's, you know, hit this guy before they hit you, or not even this guy, hit this target before the targets hit back type thing. And so it kind of makes you, I mean, obviously the games aren't doing that with their own narrative in mind. They're just trying to make it as similar to, you know, the military as possible. And I know for a fact that they bring in military kind of experts to check that they're using the right terminology and, you know, framing of kind of how objectives are laid out. So it's as similar to, you know, how things are in the real world as possible. But it does also hint at an interesting point of going, when you feel that you're empowered by your role, how does that change what you are capable of doing? So, for example, you've got, I know we chatted before this about that experiment, and maybe you want to mention that, but would a lot of the, you know, a lot of the games are terrorist or counter-terrorist, whatever, you know, you are the good guys or the bad guys because you're given this sort of role. Sometimes it's a bit gray. You don't know if your
character is... You're given a badge, really, or like a different colored uniform.
100%. Right? But it's the idea that, for example, take a game like GTA where you are... I mean, it doesn't take a genius to know that you're a criminal. You might be a criminal with a heart of gold or good intentions, or that you've been... I think a narrative they play quite often is that you've been forced into this life of crime. It's not something you want, you know. It's not like you're the career criminal on purpose. It's just that you've kind of been forced through, you know, hard times and the system, you know, to have to do these nefarious deeds. But the question goes, if you did GTA where you are a cop, and I don't mean like the typical kind of Max Payne, you know, rules are meant to be broken type cop. I just mean like a straight and narrow cop. Do you think a lot of the outcry in terms of the things you can do in GTA would diminish because it's a case of going, no, mom, I'm a cop. I'm shooting the bad guys with this tank or this katana or whatever. You know what
Sorry,
I mean?
Dude. Like, I'm just, my mental image is just like you being a beat cop in the world of GTA, like walking down the street trying to write someone a ticket and just have them like verbally abuse you. Fucking asshole. 100%. I made more money in these last 5 minutes than you made the whole fucking month.
And you just
it's like, oh shit. While you're writing them their ticket, and it's like, oh fuck, dude, I'm sorry, I already started writing this out. I can't stop it now. Yeah. shit. Oh, that would be a sad cool game, man. Not a cool time to be a cop in 2020.
Do you want to talk about that experiment, for example, on like how people, when they're empowered by a role or a duty, they do things that perhaps they wouldn't have done normally?
Okay, cool. So I hope I don't butcher this. I don't know the name of the study. It just came up while I was reading and researching. What it boiled down to was they had a control group of people, and they had to administer a questionnaire test to someone who's in like a controlled room. And that person in the room answering the questions is strapped to electrodes. And if they get the answer wrong, they get an electric shock. Now, the person in the chair is an actor. They're not actually being electrocuted, but the people who are administering the shock do think that they're shocking someone actually. And yeah. there's a slider scale that the more consistently that this person gets the answer wrong, the more severe the shock will be.
Okay.
And there's a scientist standing behind over their shoulder the whole time. So what the study showed was that people were more likely to administer the shock in greater amounts the closer the scientist is to them. So it's like that authority oversight, someone watching yeah. over your shoulder saying, even if you feel uncomfortable, saying, look, this
okay.
experiment has to continue. Please yeah. carry on. You know, they're creating this false sense of security where even though you're doing something that you think is morally wrong, we're pushing a button that makes someone scream and cry because it's shocking and causing them pain. That barrier is sort of broken because you almost have you not only permission to behave in this way in this sort of controlled scenario, but also agency. In that, like, this is a button you have to push in order to beat the game, basically. So we can see similarities here in that, you know, people are being put into a scenario where the rules of moral judgment are different in that they're judged on a different value scale. You know, when you have this authority figure telling you it's okay to push that button, you know, this is what you're meant to do. This is your role in the scenario. And not a single one, like every single person pushed the button. There was no one who was like, I'm not going to do this. Fuck you.
Because it begs a question then of like, I take a game like Bioshock, and yes, we're going to spoil it because it's been out for a decade. But the idea that you, in the end, have been brainwashed by Andrew Ryan, and every time he says, would you kindly, or if you kindly, you then do what he tells you to do next. And so what's interesting is going, but were you really mind controlled? Because you as the player still had to do those things. And yes, we can argue about the game is actually a bit on rails in the sense that you do have to do it to progress the story. But even if you know that about the ending and you play the game again, you are still doing the deed. You are still killing who he wants you to kill. You are still playing the story the way it's meant to be played. And then you can break that down.
Following the arrow.
100%. You keep following the arrow. So, you know, you can at the end go, oh, I did all those bad things, but I had to because the story made me, and actually I was mind controlled, so it doesn't matter. But like, you know, there's another very real part that going, you know, they didn't press the button for you, which I think goes into a lot of the, you go almost like Nuremberg-esque kind of trials where, you know, a lot of these big name Nazis and Nazi sympathizers were like brought on trial, and you go, yes, it's understandable that this entire machinery running that forces your hand to do certain things, and that standing up against it is tantamount to suicide. Like if you in any way went no or I'm not comfortable, you would just be, you know, killed. You'd just be taken care of, and someone else would replace you. But you still have to make the decision. It's still yours to make. You know, and so it is a tough one. Because at the end of the day, if you've got the attitude towards games of like, it's just a game, I'm just trying to progress, how much bad stuff can we put in front of you before you're like, it's not worth it? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean that this sort of like comes back to this popped into my head while you were talking about that now of players who will gloat after a kill. You know, if it's like, you know, the whole like top 10 kills of the week type vibe, right? And you check these players like styling, and you know, they'll you know, make a frag in like a really impossible, impressive way.
Yeah.
and, you know, jump up behind the computer and scream and hands in the air. And it's a big moment
like a
for them.
Proper pop off. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a proper pop off. Right. And that is like you're having like a physical in-world like response and reaction to your in-game, like your in-game, like moral value move, which might be like to kill. Right.
Are you talking about a long shot as in like, I can see the opportunity to get this is so low. So I'm going to throw this grenade and it's going to bounce off all sorts of things and gets me a multi-kill. And you're just like, wow, the odds of that happening was so low. Or are you talking about guys who are styling for the sake of it going like almost like too embarrassing?
Kind of both, right?
A pre-teabagging. We're going like, this is so ridiculous. Yeah. I'm going to show how powerful I am over you that I'm going to do this most ridiculous kill and still get it. So it's almost like I've already teabagged you. It's so ridiculous, this kill.
So what I'm trying to get at is like, let's put it this way. If our moral choices in real life depend on our moral code and we don't act immorally in real life because we will face real world judgments.
Consequences.
So if we behave inappropriately, but then we still get an overlap where the immoral act in game gets like real world applause. And real world, like it's a real world celebration of something that happened in game.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, so I think it's a bit different where with the game you're going, I might not be doing this super ridiculous move to try and dunk on you. I'm just doing it because it's like it's an absolute skill shot, and maybe it's my only chance to win. It's that attitude of play to win rather than play not to lose. So instead of playing the percentages and like the safe play, I'm going to go for the ridiculous play because, that's what gaming's about. It's about epic wins. No one cares about the games where you expected to win and you did. They care about the games where you expected to lose and you didn't. Those are the ones we tell each other. Those are the ones that every gamer has those stories by the fist load. And every chance we get, we tell our friends about them. And you can tell like other friends, they listen to them. Maybe if you have too many, they kind of go, it's another, fishing story. But if other gamers are interested in those stories, I think the difference is when, you get things like teabagging and pop-offs and that sort of stuff, where after the kill, you're doing something immoral or not immoral, but like unsportsmanlike, because then that's asking for the real world consequences of people going, oh, that guy's a bad winner. Or, it's just like ungracious in victory, that sort of stuff. I guess I maybe defend those ridiculous plays as going just a show of skill. And sometimes, let's be honest, luck, where everything just kind of the stars align and the RNG hits and everything happens at once and just it works. And you're just like not trying to be disrespectful. You're just like, man, that was lucky. I know, for example, as a Hearthstone player, when RNG hits in such a good way for yourself and such a bad way for your opponent, you actually don't even BM. You just go like, yeesh, I'm sorry. Like if that happened to me, I would go, that is a rough beat. I'm just like, I'm glad it didn't happen to me and that happened to you, person I do not know. But it's, I guess it's a great example of saying that's when your real world morality kicks in and you go, wow, I did not deserve that win. I'm very glad I got it. And so I'm humble in the bad beat that you received. but morality kicks in. I actually want to dive more into that topic of going. So we said before, games give us the opportunity to make decisions that we perhaps will never make in real life. And I'm not talking about the ridiculousness of flying dragons and killing zombies and all that. I'm talking about certain life or death decisions that, you hope that in your real life, you aren't ever forced to make those decisions. The typical being kill one person that you care about kill one person you care about and save hundreds that you don't or don't know versus, killing hundreds that you don't know to save one person that you care about. I think that's one of the classic kind of moral dilemmas. And I think it says a lot about people's psyches in terms of, utilitarian nature of whether they care about the most number of human lives or does it matter that it's someone you love or care for more than, these group of people that you don't. But I mean, let's take an example of going, a game gives you a situation like that classic, the unwashed masses versus the person you care about.
Yeah.
How much do you think who you are as a person plays into that decision? And I think there are a couple of different varieties of or variations I can chuck into the mix, but I'd like to hear your opening thoughts on that.
Yeah, so when it comes down to that, let's say this could probably fall into roughly into this category of like, you know, player chooses their own moral path, right?
Yeah.
So the games that I would use as examples there are ones where there's already a character that's been written by the game designers, let's say a Geralt, for instance, where, or like an Aloy from Horizon Zero Dawn, where I would attribute the choice that I make in that situation, for me, is the choice that I think Geralt would make in that situation. Yeah. So it's my reflection of who Geralt is in that moment in that game. And I usually go for, you know, I usually lean that character, because I play the game a number of times now, more towards the chaotic good, where he's, you know, trying to do good by others, but he himself feels as though he can't because he has, he's devoid of emotion. That's the tragic thing about that Geralt character, right? He believes that he doesn't have emotions because it was bred out of him through the mutagen, the Witcher training process. And the game kind of shows us at many different places where he's wrong about that, about himself.
Yeah.
So I feel like it makes more narrative sense for me. But you can also take it the other way, and I haven't played the game that way, where you do go for that, well, I'm a Witcher, I got no morals or emotions. I don't give a fuck who lives or dies here. I just want to collect my bag of gold. You know, there's a way to play that game also. When it comes to creating your own avatar in a game, let's say in a Skyrim or a Dragon Age or, you know, BioWare scenario, it usually comes down to how much or how little I like or dislike the NPC I'm interacting with. I've had moments where an NPC has pissed me off so much with going back and forth that I'm just like, fuck you, dude. I'll kill your goat. And like, forget about that quest and move on. And maybe that's like a flippant response, but it's a response nonetheless that I've been like pushed towards. And I don't feel as though there'll be any real like repercussions for me behaving badly in that moment. 100%. Because I can just move on to another quest and get like a blank slate, so to speak. It's like no one's really keeping score of how good or bad I've been to this particular community. Unless the game shows you that you are being scored in a certain way and certain outcomes will be different in terms of like the rewards that you'll either receive or won't receive.
Yeah, town gets angry with you and you won't. But then it's almost like a totally utilitarian decision. You're going, I want to kill your goat because you've pissed me off and that's my moral decision, but I'm deciding not to because from a utilitarian point of view, I don't want to not be able to access this village because everyone will hate me for killing your goat. So interesting question there about like, so when the character is written for you, either the decision to play the character as in this is what I think this character would do. So proper role playing, or whether it's going, this is what I would do in the scenario. I tend to agree with you when the character is your own to design. So you're not playing as Batman. You're not playing as Geralt or whatever. You're playing as, you know, whatever, your mythical name guy. I don't know why I suddenly wanted to say Aragorn or whatever. That's actually a real name. But your kind of like mythical character that you've invented, then you've decided how they interact. You either are the type that in a true kind of D&D fashion have given them their alignment. So they are a chaotic neutral or a this, that, and next thing. And so you make every decision with those in mind. Or it's one of yours to go, I'm going to play this however I want. Question though, how much do you think having someone watching you changes those decisions? And I'm going to elaborate a little bit. I think there's a classic quote. I'm not sure who by. You want to say it's one of the Benjamin Franklin types. It goes, act as if everybody is watching. Because that's like, a kind of moral compass. Because that's the kind of thing of going, I guess it's been known for the longest time that when people are watching, you tend to be your best version of yourself. You know, best in a very broad term, but like best for the goodness of society. You know, social media has made that much worse because all of a sudden things like selfless giving or, you know, being altruistic isn't without a selfie or some sort of post telling the world about it. But I guess I want to elaborate going, if you are, for example, a streamer and you have thousands of people watching you and you have to make one of those morally gray decisions, that normally you would go, from a utilitarian point of view, this is easy. I kill the guy because he has gold on him and I need the gold to buy a better sword, which will make fighting this next dragon much easier. Easy. But with thousands of people watching, do you do that? And guess what, Tim? I'm going to throw another spanner. What if, for example, your stream identity has a brand associated to it? You know, such as like you are the bad guy. You're the, you know, that's you're the bad boy. You're the, you know, contrarian. You're always against the grain, that sort of type. And now suddenly it's this decision of like, do you kill the puppies or not? And killing the puppies might have zero benefit to the game. Might be like, you don't get any benefit. It makes everything harder because everyone hates you. You get no extra gold, no benefit whatsoever. But you have to decide whether to do it because, you know, the real bad boy image that you have online would kill, you know, the puppy. Your thoughts on that?
So here's my response, and like, you're going to laugh. I don't have thousands of followers. I don't stream. It's difficult for me to respond to that part, but I do play differently when my partner's in the room and watching me play.
Fair enough. In that,
you know, if let's say I'll use the Witcher 3 example, you know, maybe I'm running from point A to point B and just suddenly randomly out of nowhere, I like use Igni on a cow and just like kill a cow and carry on going, like for no reason other than to like to kill the cow. It's like the cow was alive doing fuck all to not minding its own damn business as an NPC cow. And like, it just happened to be in my way while I was walking past and I just set her on fire and kept going. So Safia will tell me off. She will exclaim. Sometimes I might do it to get like a rise out of her, check if she's still watching me play or maybe instead of using Igni on that car, like I don't, and I hold it back knowing that like she's going to disapprove of that behavior.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
So that's an area where the way that I play is influenced by, you know, someone in proximity to me. And I think back on it now, it's like I have no reason to go chase around this cow and just like murder it. Like there's none. Nothing to do with the story quest, nothing. It's just something that you can do in the game.
Yeah, it's just cruelty.
And I happen to do it every now and then. It's just cruelty.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Okay, so now question. You're obviously comfortable enough in your relationship with Safia that you can be a little bit outside of your normal character without it being this massive like, oh my word, what did I get myself into? Change the scenario to, let's call it the pre-farting stage of a relationship where you're not that comfortable.
I call it the bloating stage. Exactly. Like holding it all in.
You just suck it in somehow. It just absorbs and seeps out of your pores. I don't know. But we've all been in that stage of relationship where you're on your best behavior. I call it the agent stage normally, where you're not actually meeting the person. You're meeting their agent because it's like a used car salesman. You know, it's got a bit of mileage and there's some baggage, but don't worry about it. You know. You know, taps on the trunk, you can fit, this is getting a bit gross, you know, four able-bodied human beings inside this thing. Like, but it's that whole thing of like just sales pitch. Like you want to be seen as your best version. Now that Tim with that girlfriend, would that Tim chase around the cow with the Igni spell?
I don't know, because it's a fine line. It's like on one, in one sense, like, it feels like I'm doing something funny in the game to show off to get a rise out of my audience. But I also don't know how my audience will respond because she might go, oh my God, how can you do that? Cows are sacred. Like,
cheers.
They dream, Tim. They dream. You know?
Even the pixelated ones.
Dreams, you know? And then I might like, you know, piss her off. So it's a fine line, but at the same time, it is like, I will acknowledge that behavior in the game is to get a rise out of someone. Like there's no need to do it. There's no reason to do it other than to get a kick from someone watching. So it's performative.
Yeah. No, good angle. I think that's pretty fair in response. And I think how most people would react to that situation is the more you know your audience, the more accurate you can be with kind of those decisions. I think the safe space, arguably, is the idea that, you know, we've attributed to Benjamin here, but like, you know, act like everybody's watching. The idea is that everybody is, you don't know them. That is the, it's what we're taught when it comes to like manners and stuff. Some people culturally, if you take burping, for example, burping's okay. They're like, eh, it's a compliment to the chef and you enjoy the food or whatever. Other people, it is like, you might as well dance in someone's grave. So the safe space is just don't burp in public or in front of people you don't know. That's the kind of safe space. It's the same with like, you know, I guess snorting or, you know, coughing in front of people. Just don't do it in front of people you don't know. If you know them and you know they'd be comfortable, go ahead. What I want to jump into now is something we chatted about off air, the idea of the moral bias being given to us by the developers and that we kind of just trust it going forward. You've called it the Joel Miller bias. I know you don't have to have listened to this podcast for a long time to know that we're fans of Last of Us. But I think if you want to unpack that a bit, I think it's just a great example of how developers can kind of place you into a scenario and make all the assumptions as to whether this character is good or evil or whatever, or neutral, and then slowly start dialing up the pressure in the similar way, actually, to that experiment you mentioned, where they're going, you know, when you're given that experiment, you're going, we as the scientist and me, the button pusher, are the good guys. The person who gets the thing wrong is clearly the bad guy and needs to be punished or educated. But as things get worse and worse, you start feeling like, are we the bad guys? You know what? As I said, it reminds me of a skit done by the Mitchell and Webb look where they, I think it's season one, where they're the Nazis and they go like, are we the bad guys? Because like, I mean, we dress in black and we have skulls on our hats. Like, they go, no, we can't be the bad guys. Like, we're killing the bad guys. Really? Because I'm just wondering, what if they think we are the bad guys? And maybe we are we the bad guys in this fight? And it makes you wonder, you know, let's jump into the Joel Miller thing, but like, where you're given one thing and then slowly the facts start changing around the scenario and you go, oh, damn, were my assumptions wrong? Was I sold a lemon here?
Yeah, so I really like how you set that up. So the Joel Miller bias, for those who don't know, Joel Miller, lead character in Last of Us, spoiler alert, Last of Us Part 2, Joel Miller expires very early in the game at the hands of Miss Abby. And there was a huge backlash to this. And I was trying to like unpack the backlash and wondering, you know, sure, there was definitely some toxic masculinity in there. Sure, definitely a bit of misogyny baked in there. But I think there's also something that people aren't aware of is the fact that, you know, that Last of Us is a video game and it makes you push the buttons as Joe Miller. His choices are your choices. And his journey is the player's journey. Mm. So when he's killed as a consequence of his actions in the second game, it's the player, it's you, in effect. Yeah. It's player one being punished for his actions. But the game never gave you any other options to push any other buttons to beat the game. So it's sort of like, you know, the game is giving you a standard of morality and telling you to conform to that, whether or not it aligns with your values and then punishes you for it. Because me looking back, it's like, well, I can't replay, you know, Last of Us Part 1 and make different decisions that might not get Joel killed in Part 2. That is just his destiny. That's what happens, right? That's what happens. So I think there's this kind of internal backlash of, but I didn't have another choice. There's no way I could have gotten around this scenario. I couldn't have done anything differently. And I think what Naughty Dog did that was quite smart was they insert this new character, Abby. They give Abby a very similar character arc and story arc to the one that Joel Miller has in the first game. But people are they get so stuck on this act that Abby did at the beginning of this game that there's like this internal struggle with, you know, even her increased screen time. I'm like warming up to Abby over time. It's not like when you start playing Ellie, it's like, oh yeah, fuck yeah, Ellie, let's go. You know, when you start playing as Abby, it's like, fuck this person. Yeah. Now I have to like, and I felt so uninterested with all her friends and all these people because I saw them with my own bias.
Yep.
And over time, being close to this character and the one she interacts with, you know, I start warming up to them and their journey.
Yeah.
Now, if we liken her then to Joel in the first game, there's a lot about Joel that you just don't know. The first time you meet him and Tess, they're busy running. They track down and beat up this dude who sold guns to the wrong person. So you're already meeting this guy in a conflict with another group. There's another scenario later on in the game where someone tries to hijack Joel and Ellie's vehicle. He pretends to be injured in the road and Joel drove straight past. And Ellie asks him, why didn't you stop? How did you know he was lying? He's like, ah, you know, I've done that kind of shit so many times. So
that one, that's like the oldest trick in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. We just don't see that scenario. We don't see the scene where Joel is bashing someone else's head in with a crowbar or with,
a golf club,
with a golf club at the beginning of the game, because the game just didn't feel that it was necessary to put us in that situation. But they make hints at it every now and then to be like, you know, maybe this oak isn't that savory. So we have this bias where we're showed the scenario, we're given this impression of Abby, and it shifts the way we feel about these characters.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's great as in that game, and I know we sing the praises of it so often, but there's definitely this feeling of, for one, a loss of agency in that, you know, there's certain things that you are forced to do that you don't want to do. I was playing it recently with my wife watching, and like two things. One, we have to interrogate the one woman, and it's like, there's no option. You press square to beat her to pulp with the, you know, lead pipe. You can't avoid that. And you're like, I don't want to. I've even stepped away. I think I told you before, stepped away, make them coffee, come back 5 minutes later. You're still waiting to, you know, quick time event her to death.
Yeah.
And then the later in the game when, you know, you right at the end, you've got a decision essentially to fight Abby or to escape in one of the other two boats. There are two boats, but you don't. You take it. You're not given that decision. You literally, the game forces you into this loss of agency and having to do this terrible thing. Because as visceral as that fight is, I don't think a lot of people would have chosen that. They would have gone, the right decision is to forgive her. She's forgiven you multiple times. You know, it's almost like you've gotten even in the way of like, you've let her off the hook. There's almost like, there's more a sense of getting even in that sense of going, you let me off the hook twice. Even though, you know, you could have killed me both times. And now I've got one up on you because I'm letting you go, you know, even though I could have killed you, but you don't, and you're forced into it. And I don't think that's the decision most people would have made. Obviously, we are at a loss for knowing if there's a third game and what it's going to be like and whether this plays into a much bigger story. But given what we know, I don't think that was the ending most people wanted. But then the other thing is that, like, through that loss of agency and what you can and can't do, you watch Ellie deteriorate from being the hero of the game into, it feels like that meme of, you know, the enemy of the game or the villain of the game, the real villain.
Yeah.
And you go, the villain of the first game, you would say, if there's a villain, like an actual character villain, you would go, the villain is the clickers and all the infected. The real villain of the game is Joel Miller. You know, then you go into the second game. The villain of the game is Abby. That's who we're trying to kill, right? The real villain of the game is Ellie. You know, it's almost like this, that's the story of going, you start the game at one point, so you're given information about the infected, and that's the who you're trying to beat, and you're trying to find a cure, and you go, those are the bad guys. But as information passes throughout the game, and when you complete it, you go, geez, were we really the bad guys? Because the clickers are pretty chilled, like neutral, chaotic, as it were, compared to some of the human forces at play. And then you jump into the second game and you go, was Abby really the bad person? She was essentially just defending her father and essentially the whole human race who Joel had denied a cure.
Yeah.
And she lets Ellie off. She lets Tommy off. She lets everybody off. She just wants to kill Joel for being essentially a bad person and destroying the human race potentially. And for that, Ellie can't forgive her. And it just keeps spiraling downwards as well as like Abby starts redeeming herself by looking after scars and helping all these other people and understanding that everyone's different and that, you know, we've got a bigger thing, you know, bigger problems. Shit. Yeah. I mean, that's
for me a
classic.
So,
she's a classic example of how, like, as the facts change, your moral bias towards a character changes a lot with it.
So I wanted to kind of highlight a few of the comparisons between like Abby's character and Joel's character and their character arcs. So in with Joel, he's first contextualized as someone who is helping this young girl. But really for him, it's you get a sense that he's doing it to try and make up for all the shit that he's done in his past.
Yeah.
And you can attribute
he's lost a female character in his life. And so attributes a lot of that, I think, was redemption. Helping Ellie helps him resave his... Did he have a daughter or something? And
he had
a
wife.
And
died,
and he's trying to, like, redeem that.
So, you know, on the other hand, Abby, very similar. But the key difference is that when you first see her, she's inflicting this act of violence on a character we care about. And only after then do we see her go on this kind of like redemption savior journey to make up for the bad shit that she did in the past. You know, she also lost a father figure and she's trying to make up for that through and learning about herself and her fears through these characters, you know, these scars that she's keeping alive. And in the same way, you know, within the, in the first game, I can't exactly remember what happens, but Joel gets seriously fucked up. And that's when you kind of come back, you start playing as Ellie, right? And she's like nursing him back to health. So you're nursing him back to health. And the same thing kind of happens to Abby. She gets captured. She gets, you know, her body deteriorates over, she's tortured, you know, kept held captive over a couple of months. And that's when Ellie finds her at the end of the game and wants to, you know, get back into the beef. And at that point, Abby's a very different character.
Yeah.
You can say that Joel might be a different character after his sort of, you know, torture
wounding.
Period.
Yeah, yeah.
His wounding. But for him, that, you know, Ellie nursing him back to health is an act that brings them closer together and kind of like further solidifies this father-daughter sort of bond that they have going. Because now instead of him saving her and looking after her, it's the roles are reversed and she's doing that for him. So you can see how just that scene that that just contextualizes the way reframes, we think about this character, frames them, and the game then challenges how we approach that character and feel about that character and how we attribute like what we how we think they should behave, our own moral bias, onto them.
Yeah, that's it's a gray soup. That's exactly what
it's a great fucking soup, eh?
I think the key call out of this entire thing is going, morality does exist in games. I don't think we can deny it. Whether it affects you as the player is, I think, up to your own kind of, you know, how much you engage with the game. Because at the end of the day, you could treat everything simply as the typical kind of three-act response to a movie, as in identifying the playing pieces, cause the tension, resolution. So it's like, you are the player, you've been given a problem, resolve it, either fail or succeed. And so whether it's something as morally gray as Last of Us or The Witcher, or black and white like a Sonic or Mario, or neutral like a Tetris game, you know, you decide whether it's whether you're investing on the morality side of things or not. And I think the key thing really is that the more one understands how morality plays a part in these games, I personally think the more A, enjoyment, but B, enriching the experience can be. Obviously, we're talking less about the morality and things like Mario and Sonic and all that, but when you get into these really deep story games, I was chatting to Megan, my wife, about how movies are in trouble compared to what games are doing and can do in terms of personal investment in it. Because, you know, you play, if I'd watched Last of Us as a movie, yes, and Megan watched most of it as a movie over the course of 18 hours, however long it took us to play through, like, it was like watching a series. There was the investment in the characters, who you liked, who you didn't like. But you can't compare it to playing as those characters because it checks your morality. And I think particularly when I don't know if it's better or worse when it's put on rails like Last of Us is, the moral decisions. Because, yes, I feel like they're less my own decisions, but when I'm forced to make decisions I wouldn't make, yeah, it really does check how it makes you feel about those decisions. Whereas sometimes when you are making decisions yourself, when it gets too uncomfortable, well, then you make the moral decision that is more comfortable. You're not forced into making those decisions that you don't need to. And arguably, is that not what games bring us that makes them so unique? Because when we have a situation in our own lives where our morals dictate the decision, it almost becomes a no-brainer decision because morally I couldn't live with the other decision. Yeah. And games that let us choose either way, you know, we might still go, wow, I cannot bring myself to do that. Even I can't torch the cow because I'm a PETA member. And if they found out, you know, I'm still not going to make that decision. But, you know, when the game forces us through it, sure, does it really not check who we are as people in terms of decision? You know, unless, of course, we're the mindless type that just go, eh, it's just a game and I just want to finish it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say, like, from my side, closing thoughts, games are in, like, a really powerful position right now. You know, simply because we have this, you know, huge generation that have grown up with video games and the technology just improved so much that they are able to get into these sort of the meaty subject matter that really, like, pulls us in different directions. You know, the fact that Last of Us is on rails, you can't choose not to torture that girl with a lead pipe. Yeah. You have no other option but to push that button. I remember there was one moment on the Abby playthrough, the boss fight, you fight Ellie as the boss fight, right? Mm. And the first round, I let Ellie waste me. And I'm like, cool, that's the alternative timeline. In that time, like, the game ends there. You know, but that's not gonna, like, beat the level. I could turn my PlayStation off and take the game out and be like, that's how it should have ended. Good game, well played. But that wasn't the director's, like, vision. And the fact that, you know, I think Naughty Dog are quite aware of the fact that they do recontextualize these characters. It does kind of push and pull you in different ways and force you to feel a certain way about a character that even if it conflicts with the way that you're feeling at a particular time, and hopefully over time changing your perspective and your idea about things. And that's powerful. Like, you know, you have the controller in your hands, and that's something that you can't really say about, you know, other forms of traditional narrative media, like, you know, movies or series, for instance, that can take you along for the journey as an outsider or, you know, looking in, but they can't necessarily put you in the shoes and make you pull, you know, push the kill switch, for instance.
100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great space, and it feels so good to have been on this journey and watched games develop, because I'm not going to lie, I bought into a lot of these stories as the player when they weren't as good. Well, maybe the stories, it's not that the stories weren't as good, but they certainly weren't as immersive. But you bought in because that's, you know, back to our Mortal Kombat thing, that's as good as the performance and the capabilities that were available to the developers. And now as things are getting almost limitless in scope, it's just it's a great time to be a gamer. I hope everyone enjoyed this podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed this discussion. This topic over the last 2 weeks has been really, really engaging. If you have any thoughts or contributions or things you'd like to add, please do at us on Twitter. We're at @guru_podcast. Otherwise, Tim is at @TimAndAfish, and I'm at @TheGarethWoods. As always, it's been an absolute pleasure, Tim, and we will see you all next week with another juicy topic. Until then, have fun and see you then.
Ciao. Ooh, baby.